Investments, it protects over $12 million in revenue. We're excited to ensure that our key public services can continue to be seamlessly provided. We have ensured that each measure we have designed achieves the purpose of raising revenue where possible and avoiding any austerity or hardship in any instance. As a result, many of the revenue measures that we're announcing today with a heavy heart are going to be in place only for 2 years, that is to say, 24 months. These will be measures that are designed to bring back that before and after was the express agreement of the leader of the opposition and the opposition spokesperson for public finances agreeing to take from the public's coffers in order to pay for the worst damage of the COVID. What we all agreed to be paid out, we must all of our contributors to come back. What we all took for benefit of in the extraordinary funding of our health and care services for this period, we must all of our contributors to pay back. What all sectors in our economy, directly or indirectly, took the benefit of, we must all of our contributors to put him back in. There are no free rides for this people, and Gibraltar has never had a free ride. The triple tailors from both our nations have no free ride, and our generation has recognized that when lines in the lead are, in most instances, commonly, how we must therefore all contribute to the recovery of our public finances. But let's be crystal clear. This budget will contain no austerity because it contains no cut of jobs or services. But it will cut our people's personal prosperity in the way that we leave untouched the income of the workforce in our community who actually see their income grow as a result of the measures I'm going to announce today. The most vulnerable and those with the lowest income, disability benefits and state pensions, as well as those on public sector occupational pensions, will see their income continue to grow. We will in that way protect them as vulnerable. But if we are all genuinely committed to social justice, then we must see that the most well-off spend a little more. If only for a few years, in a way that is designed to pay off the debt we have incurred to pay our way in the pandemic. I emphasize, Mr. Speaker, that the spending we are talking about repaying is the spending we have all in this House agreed we should incur. This is not to pay for schools, new rental homes for the elderly, or affordable homes for young families, the refurbishment of housing estates, new primary care centres, sports facilities, or other projects. Each of those projects is a worthy, important project for our community. None of these represents any lavish spending or any project which any member of this House has spoken out against or suggested we should not proceed with. Nor is it to pay for the pay of public sector workers, which we have increased considerably. The spending we will have to all contribute to is to pay the spending we all agree to in this House, and which relates directly to the disbursement of money by the government to address the real hardships that the pandemic would otherwise have visited upon this community. Because by spending to spend, we prevented what could have been mass unemployment and the mass closure of businesses. Indeed, we prevented many of the problems now affecting other economies, where the restart of some parts of their activity is impaired, not least in the aviation industry. So, Mr. Speaker, in the context of the continually difficult historic moment in which we find ourselves, I must tell all honourable members that this will no doubt be seen as a tough but necessary budget. Tough, because whilst the government will assist and protect the most vulnerable, we will ask for more from those who can. But necessary, because there comes a time in the affairs of many where it cannot be all take. And we have been clear already, Mr. Speaker, that we believe that we must never be spending more than we collect. Annual expenditure must not exceed annual revenue. And because of the truly exceptional circumstances of the past 2 years, not for any other reason, annual expenditure presently does exceed annual revenue. That is what we have to correct, or we will continue for longer than would be forgivable, and it is presently forgivable, to breach our own golden rule, as set out by Sir Stephen Fowler in his first address as Chief Minister in a budget debate after 1982. reflect for a moment. Because last Thursday, the 23rd of June, was not just the unfortunate 6th anniversary of a very unhappy president, that is to say, the anniversary of voting in the great referendum. The 23rd of June was also the 50th anniversary of the 1972 German election. That was the first general election that saw Joseph John Bosana elected to the House of Assembly, the Parliament's predecessor, with 4,383 votes. The Honourable, the father of the House, the Joe Bosana, has therefore now been a Member of Parliament for more than 50 years. And on this side of the House, Mr. Speaker, we express our congratulations to him on this magnificent milestone. And for the huge benefits that his work as a parliamentarian has delivered to Gibraltar and Gibraltarians in the course of the half century that he has served our people. Additionally, Mr. Speaker, we would also congratulate him on his persuasion to so many of the naysayers on the opposite benches who now say that support his economic policy and his policies on international relations. No one now is against the accumulation of rainy day funds, like the GST used to be. Incidentally, Mr. Speaker, these are now once again wealthy, even at this time. No one now backs the Brussels Center, as the GST did when it was formed. No one now speaks out against the future job strategy, as the GST used to do, and I think Mr. Phillips is not here to hear my response to his building on that. Even sooner, Mr. Speaker, James, he doesn't understand all of these arguments. The piano convert to what they used to call low-committee economics and unrealistic cherry picking. So I'm here to praise Bosana, not to blame him. But the fact is that men on the other side have made it their life's work to come to this place, to blame Bosana, not to praise him. Although in that sense, they would be true to the original Shakespeare, Mr. Speaker. They must happily abandon their original principles, no surprises there. And they adopted a penalty to you cannot be seen joining him approach to preserve, which would on this side of the House warmly welcome on the occasion of this auspicious anniversary. The opposite, of course, Mr. Speaker, would have now found another, the very opposite, Mr. Speaker, of course, have now found another target for their detection. And you're listening to them, Mr. Speaker. I have absolutely no difficulty with that, and they can have the comfort that I have no intention of being in the position. But let us return to Mr. Bill and this golden rule. What would members opposite embrace and assume, depending on whatever rule to take their hands to and which we regard as sacrosanct? To observe the golden rule and reap its benefits for our nation, it is immediately necessary that all those of us who can take a step forward and contribute a little more, even if it is for a short period of time, must simply to get the whole community over the COVID hump. Of course, Mr. Speaker, we're only still dealing with the negotiations with the EU on a treaty on our future relationship. The reality is that the absence of that treaty has meant that there has been an unwelcome element of uncertainty in our economy. The other side of the coin of that reality is that we cannot accelerate the negotiation if it would mean that yes, the government will be unacceptable simply to how the present alone. The Conservative Liberal Party, which I represent, have a very clear view of what is and is not acceptable to us in this context and what is and is not acceptable to the people of Gibraltar. So everyone who can delay to suggest that we are somehow to blame for the delay in not having treaty cannot be the voice that is concerned to ensure that the state treaty is safe and secure for Gibraltar. Because we cannot work with negotiation other than by accepting things that we would not otherwise be prepared to accept. And we will not do that. And in the next anticipation of a good from honourable members in this House on this debate, Mr. Speaker, it would be inherently contradictory to complain that we have not gone fast enough and at the same time suggest that we must ensure that Gibraltar's sovereignty and jurisdiction control must be properly and fully protected. Undoubtedly, however, leaving the European Union has created uncertainty, and that will have had economic consequences, of course. I will speak more later in my address to update the House on the latest on the treaty negotiations. But still, of course, matters of speaker was all to be considered in a filtered relation debate, such as the debate on the appropriation bill. But what we have to the conundrum. Of course, we have suffered delays and conclusions. All has not a good time. In fact, they also acknowledge that each of our heartfelt petitions, from purchases of church and counter-guard and box and CD, resulting to the delays inevitably taken to those two projects. I look forward to meeting the organizers of the system, so that we can discuss the reasons for the delays and the cost increases that are likely on those projects. But I refuse to believe that the Gibraltarians do not really understand deep down the difficulties we have faced and the inevitable delays to projects that have arisen, whatever the more impetuous may prove to blindly post in social media. Because our fellow Gibraltarians know and understand that we did not choose COVID and the uncertainty was greater than the work it has required. We did not bring COVID upon ourselves and the economic and social difficulties it has created around the world. We would not have been Ukraine with the inflation and pressures that we have brought. These forces are external factors and their consequences have to be dealt with and managed. And I do not think that me or any Gibraltarian would have made different choices in the circumstances we have found ourselves in than those we made ourselves. However critical some may be, it is a bit in my care that we would have done the same thing in 9 or 10 out of 10 of the instances in which we have had to make choices. But when all this is said and done, just as I told the House last year, in the end, it will of course be my responsibility that we should get this right. And I think the responsibility that I am genuinely honored to fill with our country at this time. Because we, all of us in this side, and I, will not cower in the face of these difficulties. We will not to dinner or being rather frozen in headlights. We will continue to. We will continue to work. We will continue to expand through and out of these circumstances. And today, Mr. Speaker, marks an important moment in doing so, and we set out to prescribe the measures that we will all have to contribute to in order to do so. Mr. Speaker, forgive me, I expect some of you will want to argue that the state of Gibraltar post-pandemic public finances and consequently, the notice that we have to take is somehow the fault of the GSLP Liberal government. That is probably the only political trick in the book. By blaming the Labour government in the United Kingdom for the debt in 2010, without accepting that the debt arose from a worldwide economic crunch and the need to put champions to stop a total collapse of the bank and the country's market. It was a defeat in the division. Then to use the argument of an excuse for the austerity that followed, and that progressively hurt working people, while exonerating the teachers that had been saved by the previous government spending. I will not stand idly by as the same cruel trick is attempted in Gibraltar to pull the wool over the eyes of the Gibraltarians. Naturally, we are in government charge and we are responsible for the public finances. But from that to being to blame for a deficit and the finance is quite a threat. In this respect, I made the statement last week on the evolution that the effect of the pandemic was that, whatever had happened before, and whether or not we had followed the opposition's advice or not, we would have ended up in the same place. It has been suggested by some now that those who were actually referring to the deficit and not the debt. Very quickly, it was suggested that the opposition said that they would have ended up in a deficit position, but not that the debt would have increased and it has as a result. Though I think such a debate is, I think it's important to highlight that the deficit is being plugged by borrowing. That is to say, the debt is going up because we are plugging the deficit by borrowing. So, Mr. Speaker, even though we will no doubt face a continued serenity in the approach we face in this debate, and provide the obvious answer to the argument we expect to hear in coming days. Because if one goes and becomes the argument that the economic and public finances that Gibraltar faces today is the fault of the government of Gibraltar, is not being objective in their analysis. I can understand that those who are just perennially opposed to the government might do that. But in a certain mindset, objective, independent observer, will appreciate that the point of arrival of the pandemic was the point of reducing direct government debt, deficit, and increased revenue over expenditure. That is why, despite many attempts to try and get that argument to stick, it has stuck only in the quarters that want it to stick. What has covered us with impetus is the threefold aspect of the deployment of public money to 3,000 or 4,000 work by the closure of businesses, the closing of our economy and other economies that deprived us of our revenue at the same time, to a position from which
recovery will take some time, and in addition, myriad of expenses included. It's that simple. We have a good system because we spend money to keep food on people's table and to keep our companies going. We spent money to fund the humanitarian public sector to kill through COVID. We spent money to plug the revenue gap from our falling or disappearing revenue. The speaker, that gap is so bad, and government revenue has not yet fully recovered. We are not in this situation because we built a school, built a primary care center, or built new affordable homes. And the measures that we will take to make tough and painful those funding may be, have a clear purpose in putting up a clear direction out of these difficulties. To get back to the bottom track, to get back to growth, and to get back to profitability. Balancing the bottom of the figure, which is what our right-thinking citizens want us to do. Before we get into the economic detail, it is also important to remind ourselves that this debate has always been wider than just an economic debate, or is it being just about the public finances? Let us go right approach, that the economic well-being of a nation comes from the social and political well-being of a nation. So equally false for us to consider the wider the citizens of life in Gibraltar will be considered a good. And that reflects the figure. I think we are well placed to reflect positively on a decade of social investment, social progress, and the social reform which has landed well and the business itself deeply enough. We have refurbished, old, and tired of food, and we will refurbish more of them as our public finances recover. We have added a massive new green areas in the center of our city. Commonwealth Park and Camden Park serve as everybody's back garden in Gibraltar now. Through commitments to improving our common environment and our people's quality of life. We have built and are building new schools so that by the time our program is finished, every school in Gibraltar will have been built by the GSAP, including a new university. Additionally, we will have employed 172 more teachers in 10 years. That is where your money is going, Mr. Speaker, not on nugget spending at summer end. We have employed 170 more learning support assistants in 10 years. That is not more spending, that is investment in education. We have employed 137 more nurses in the GK in the last 10 years. And we have employed almost double the number of more GPs in 10 years, although we still have to get them right and to organize appointments with them. That is where your money is going, Mr. Speaker. In fact, the total complement in Exhibit 16 education is up from 607 when we took over to 1,123 now. The total complement of the GOK, which can be seen as Exhibit 2, has gone up from 869.5 when we took over to 1,185. That is where your money is going, Mr. Speaker. Authority is about cutting people in such roles. We have done no such thing. We have invested in quality jobs with the best terms and conditions of employment, exceeding even those in which we used to match parity before. We have built brilliant new facilities for our elderly at Hillside and Ballista, as well as establishing our program in the British Hill and opening the Joint Mac Room for the elderly. We have provided two new primary care facilities for our people, one of them for children. In fact, the government believes that these are not just operating as they should, and they need to be reviewed, and we're in the process of doing so. We have built and are building more affordable homes than we have ever seen built by any administration in our history. Delays have arisen from the pandemic, of course. Nothing we can do about that, and although Labour government will no doubt try and pull the delay on us. Lots of problems, Mr. Speaker, and I fully expect them to try and pin the blood gas, the flame, and the Vietnam War on us during the course of this debate if they think it will help them to gain one or two more political points. But we continue doing. We have built car parks that provide facilities for those of our people who wanted to buy car parking spaces. We are providing new facilities for our broadcasting corporation so that they have the modern studios and equipment that they need. We have about a 700-plus arena for small boats and will soon provide a hard once we settle the outstanding assets with the .com which come from the timing government of members opposite. We held great concerts, the cost of which we subsidized for whole families to enjoy when we could. And we built and established the University of Gibraltar as a center of learning, which has long been an ambition of the city government that we have made a reality. And this is the Gibraltar International Bank, a reality that our government's folk political commitment. We have built a model to produce the best sporting facilities our athletes have ever enjoyed. The growth is impossible to manage for reasons already repeatedly explained in this house. But again, I have no doubt that the belief will also be said by the opposition to be lawful, just like what Cuba missile crisis in the Korean War II. Nothing will be too remote in time or geography, for the GSP not to say it was the government's fault, the government's fault, or the GSP liberal's fault. All these things can be said very quickly. So we can go on to the speaker. But what a legacy to speak in the past 10 years. What they have spoken of these things and promised them, we have made them happen. Not without great effort. Very late nights and a massive amount of work involving ministerial colleagues and great public servants. That is how we work with these people. And if not, it's management by any definition. It is the legacy of a golden, faithless, liberal, decaying portability. Outlets that, like the whole world was, by the pandemic that took the prisoners around the world and has taken a hundred and four of our most beloved people. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, the best way to demonstrate that the issues affecting our economy today are not limited to our actions or to our alleged management or anything which we might have undertaken, which is now the expected collective imagination, is best set out by a quote from members of it. And of course, and this is a direct quote, and of course, no one on this side of the House is saying that if they had been prudent with the people's money over the last 10 years, which would have avoided an £157 million deficit, which is, of course, COVID related, and no one could have predicted the pandemic. That is correct, of course. But it is actual statement, a direct quote, from the member for the Liberal Law, Mr. Peter, speaking, as he told it, on behalf of the opposition, because the leader of the opposition had asked him to address the issue. And that very realistic assessment, which accords to our own understanding, has stopped the members opposite from now seeking to subject the opposite with any credibility. The political obstacle created will nonetheless no doubt be ignored at the altar of political convenience. But that little moment of lucid honesty which Mr. Peter brought to last year's debate will forever be recorded in the Chancellor of this House and the political history of this community. For that, I thank you. In fact, Mr. Speaker, what we delivered before that was a boost to Gibraltar's society and for our nation. A massive step forward in a decade of hard work and comprehensive government. A generational step change which we have delivered for our people. Precisely, that we have not enough. I know it, at least we have things to do. Only the basic things that have gone awry in the pandemic that we have to fix. Those things will come too much. You can never please everyone, Mr. Speaker. Sometimes it seems that we can never please anyone. Certainly, we are on the opposite benches, at least, Mr. Speaker. But we have satisfied ourselves that we have done what we said we would, insofar as we reasonably could, until the pandemic struck. We have not been idle one day since we were entrusted by the people to govern our nation's affairs. We have not been complacent one moment since we took over in December 2011. And we have been humble always in the discharge of our functions. And true to the principles of natural justice and the same principles of public life set out by Lord Nolan and our draft ministerial code, I trust we will now be able to do the work of the third committee to finish that adoption of it formally. And to further tighten that, Mr. Speaker, we will very soon be publishing a bill to provide additional protection to prevent any semblance of corruption in our society. With people having gone foot and cold on it, and having insisted that we should not proceed with it, I hope all members of it will support the bill when it is published in coming weeks. Gibraltar is now also freer and more open than ever before. Freedom and equality is established in the spirit of the sexual orientation. It was a pleasure, therefore, to have attended this pride event on Saturday to represent all of Gibraltar then. And if you ask, why should we have a gay pride event? For a simple reason, Mr. Speaker, because the opposite is no longer true in Gibraltar. There is no gay shame. That is why we celebrate equality with pride. We are also making much better, but as yet imperfect provision for the disabled in our community. We have started the work on the extension of the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. The provision is already commenced being led by the Ministry for Equality, working with the Ministry of Equality and other departments. This has been a long process with various stages, some of which are not under our direct control. The extension has always been our ambition, which we've set out on a number of occasions in the past, since we were in opposition. This is, of course, linked to the Disability Act, which was passed in the Parliament and which is modelled on the Bill. In particular, you will recall that there are two sections of that act that have not yet been commenced, and this was in order to give time to plan and for premises to be made accessible. In the 2019 budget, I announced the initiative to enable businesses to claim a tax deduction equal to the expenditure of work to improve their property up to a maximum of £15,000. This was to encourage businesses to facilitate access to people with disabilities in their existing premises. That measure was made available for 36 months. But regrettably, the COVID pandemic got in the way of that initiative, as was seen in London. And as the very first budget measure today, I announced that I intend to reinstate this provision for another 24 months. Every community is a work in progress, but it is challenged with our opponents not to congratulate us on the progress achieved so far. I will not dwell further on the subject of social progress and inclusion and equality, but I will repeat my warning. Whilst I have breath in my body, I will continue to ensure that we move only in one direction in this respect. Forward. Gibraltar has no reverse gear on rights and progress in particular. The progressive road to equality is a one-way road. Any attempt to reverse the law to prevent discrimination will have ferocious opposition from the majority to any such attempt. Because Gibraltar is a socially liberal European democracy, and we have taken our place at the table of nations with modern, progressive laws, very often opposed from the majority of those on the opposite benches. And not opposite, Mr. Speaker, but on the one-year anniversary of the Cloning Act, or abortion referendum in Gibraltar, the United States Supreme Court would have ruled to undo 15 years of federal protection to women's reproductive rights. While others moved backwards, Mr. Speaker, we moved forward. Only forward. And speaking of matters European, I will now update the House on the progress of the EU negotiation. At this time last year, we had not even seen the publication of the mandate of the European Committee for the negotiation. When we saw the EU mandate, we all agreed that it presented many unacceptable aspects which the government and people of Gibraltar would never be able to agree. Now we have engaged directly with the European Commission on 9 rounds of negotiations. Technical discussions are ongoing today, Mr. Speaker. We have made huge progress in understanding each other's positions. I think it is safe to say that the areas where we have found agreement. Most importantly, there are areas where, whether we agree in principle or not, we're not yet able to agree in mechanics of how to give effect to our agreement. Yes, this is longer than any of us would have expected, but it is a negotiation of the conflict which we have to get right. This usually is a process where the average of more things, less speed, is going to be what gets us to the right conclusion. At the moment, the talks are processing through a deeply technical stage, where some of the detail of the parts of the Schengen Acquis and the relevant parts of the Acquis movement of goods have been considered. We have to ensure that this has been fully and properly analysed between the parties in order to make beyond their intention. So when we do reach an agreement, or when we find that agreement, we find no nasty surprises, and we have addressed all of those issues in the course of the negotiation. The technical teams for the government of Gibraltar are being led today by Michael Gammas, who is the Attorney General, who is immersed in highly complex work. The Deputy Minister and I are equally involved in all policy aspects which the technical work throws up. The numbers of meetings have been innumerable, and the numbers of meetings to come will likely be innumerable. But it is worth remembering that this is not a process that we are embarked upon by choice. We have not decided that we wish to recast our relationship with the European Union because we woke up one morning and decided to do so. It may sound quite decisive, but it is important to remember. We are embarked on this process because we must, as a result of the Brexit referendum, work to fashion the recasting of our relationship with the EU into the best possible form. And if the best form we can negotiate is not safe and secure, then so be it. But we must pursue this course. And I'm confident, Mr. Speaker, that we will reach agreement and that the agreement will recast our relationship with Europe going forward. It is also presenting us, Mr. Speaker, operations and under the system of government. Too often, it has been cheaper for successive governments of Spain to go to historic prejudice than to move forward to dialogue and cooperation. We may be seeing a change, and every Gibraltarian will want to welcome that if it takes root and is not lost to the rise of far-right extremism in Spanish politics. But the opportunity may now be there. And that is why we remain committed to seeking to resolve the nature of our future relationship with the EU through a UK-EU treaty which is free and secure on all our fundamental concerns. And we think this is the case, essentially, with the EU, as has no sovereignty claim on Gibraltar. Because we do believe that we can deliver such a treaty in a manner which creates that mythical shared prosperity of which we all talk and which we perforce leads to an advanced prosperity in Gibraltar, which is where prosperity spreads from. Mr. Speaker, I remain deeply optimistic that such a free and secure treaty is possible and is now increasingly probable. The links to several negotiations are very tough and very tricky, and they are dealing with difficult areas of policy. They require deep maturity in understanding the European rules as they are between member states, and how they would apply to us in the context of non-membership of the EU or of Finland, but of adherence to the international treaty and the application of public international law. But what I would therefore warn against is the idea put out by some aspiring voices that we can be done with quicker by some in some way, or that we are failing by not bringing it in quicker. It is worth every member of the community remembering that in Greek mythology, Mr. Speaker, the sirens were dangerous creatures who lured sailors with their enchanting music and singing voices to shipwreck on the rocky coast of their island. In the past, some such sirens have taken to be done like Northern Ireland. Of course, when we pointed out the differences, those who made the argument stopped. In fact, now it can be seen that those who argued with the beast like Northern Ireland would have seen that there would have been little merit in that. They now come full circle and are arguing, like us, that the Gibraltar negotiation is very different from the Northern Ireland negotiation. The same sirens, Mr. Speaker, have even called for a deal in which Gibraltar's external relations became the responsibility of the President of the European Commission. That is not something we would consider would be safe and secure. I do appreciate that they have come round to our position, because they do not face it. I would also say that the need is to do things quicker, but they also urge us not to concede anything fundamental. Not that we would, and that we might need them to remind them. But of course, the only way to go faster is to concede things we are not prepared to concede. We are never going to compromise our British sovereignty, jurisdiction, and control. So anyone who thinks we have gone soft on the fundamentals, and who thinks that they would be able to argue that in a way to somehow lure our supporters away with siren calls to the rock, is in for a shock. Because we will not compromise on the fundamentals, and neither are we being asked to do so. But we have been right to be cautious and to be careful in our negotiations. There is too much at stake for the daughter and for those around us to get things wrong. And if we are put under pressure in the process of negotiation, we have to ignore that pressure in order to negotiate successfully, however much the pressure may produce negative effects in the interim. And I'm very, Mr. Speaker, the difficulty being experienced by blue and other colour ID card holders. But an official action in reaction to things that may be happening, our opponents, our supporters, and the general public need to think about what the alternatives are to the steps we are taking. And any such thinking must be deep thinking. That is the thing, Mr. Speaker. People should not blindly think that it would be proper to react in this complex and important negotiation as one does in a brawl. This negotiation is no brawl, Mr. Speaker. It is as much a game of chess as it is of poker, where we all have to win and none of us can lose. Not easy, but nothing worth doing in politics ever is easy. And neither will this budget be easy, Mr. Speaker, or the numbers that I will now report to the House arising from the sensitive background that I have described. Mr. Speaker, last time I delivered a full budget address, last year was July 2021. Over the last few years in economic terms, the entire world has changed. But as I've highlighted last year and every year, my focus has to remain on this small part of the world that we call home. We can now play that, and we must preserve it as much as possible. First, who were hit by the unexpected departure of the United Kingdom from the European Union. The extraordinary disruptions and the uncertainty created by the vote and the subsequent negotiations of our departure caused huge problems to a previously settled economic environment. And to think that Brexit seemed so seismic at the time, that we call these politically instigated problems turbulence and challenges. People didn't know what earthquake really was to come next, because Brexit was as a result of the impact of COVID. The continuing economic effects of that pandemic is the subject of much of my research. Then, after its effects as the world started, eventually the after effects as the world started opening up, we also the tensions between supply and demand played out in the new default stage. These tensions translated immediately to increased prices and worldwide pressures on labour forces as these had been displaced during the lockdown. This has resulted in further shortages, such as delays on deliveries of motor vehicles, cars, and then cuts, such as those we can all relate to, as long queues at security checks at airport systems. Additionally, all of this turbulence has unfortunately been severely compounded by the war in Ukraine, which really has thrown global markets into crisis. The importance of self-sufficiency in energy and other factors has been brought to a halt as we see larger countries of Europe grapple with their conscience in the face of possible sanctions from what is truly deliverable, despite the tough rhetoric given their dependence on fuel from Russia. This is the main factor we've been facing as far as it is, the effect of which I will analyze later tonight. These are all crucial lessons for us in Gibraltar, as we continue to carefully calibrate the arrangements we might be able to negotiate as part of our own agreement arising from Brexit. In this context, it is perhaps useful for me to update the recent history on GDP growth to provide a sense of how Gibraltar has performed in the face of all these external factors. I only need to emphasize here that all of these factors, be they COVID shortages, price inflation, Brexit, and how the effects of the war in Ukraine are affecting us, are external forces which we as a small nation are in need of. We are buffeted by these forces, but we have no way to arrest them or manage these international issues. We can only ensure the integrity of HMS Gibraltar and work to ensure that she is a ratified ship that will withstand any storm. And it's really quite remarkable how a small place like Gibraltar has found its own way of adapting and dealing with these issues. But with everything, this is a continuing journey, not a destination. So it is important to reflect on the journey so far to ensure also the comfort and longevity of the traveller as we continue to navigate the course. From relocations of public offices to the COVID helpline and related duties have now existed in government departments such as the statistics office. The government statistics office has nonetheless provided their budget brief which forecast GDP and revises historic forecasts in light of actual information. But the people who walk the house through some of these figures, pointing only to thank the chief statistician and the team for the work that they do in delivering these 10 metrics for our economy. But the people will recall that last year I provided a preliminary estimate for the figures for 2019-20. That the main estimates I quoted last year, based on the information provided by the government statistics office, was for a GDP of 2.57 billion. I'm delighted to confirm that the final estimate for 2019, the final year before the pandemic, which really started at the end of March 19, has not varied materially from that preliminary estimate. There has been a small positive increase in the final estimate of around 2.1 million, which will not move the needle of the rounded figure of 2.57 billion. I explained last year that this represented an increase now of 112 million, namely 4.6% as adjusted over the figure for 2018-19. I assume that this growth was below the average growth rate during my government's term in office, and has arisen from relocations in the gaming sector caused by Brexit. And here, once again, is that first external factor impacting on our economy. This figure now turns to the preliminary estimate for 2020-2021. Last year, I provided a forecast for that figure of 2.44 billion. The preliminary estimate is slightly below that at 2.41 billion, a reduction of some £25 million, while that's again not material in the context of those figures. As the figure I explained last year, this reduction did not come as a surprise to anyone, given the lockdowns and the other factors affecting the economy. It is consistent with the direction of travel of the growth traffic in other mature economies. Once again, these figures were not a direct result of anything we have in control of. Because I also believe that the global economy has performed remarkably well. So the lockdown and restrictions and non-essential travel, as well as the result of the COVID-19 pandemic, had a significant negative effect on Gibraltar's economy in 2021. That was estimated to have contracted by 5.9% in nominal terms to $2.42 billion and decreased by 7.2% in real terms. To correct the forecast I gave last year and bring this up to date, the preliminary GDP forecast for 2020 is $2.41 billion, that is a reduction of $152 million, or that declining of 5.9% over the 2019-20 final estimate. Income from employment in group trading property companies are estimated to have dropped by 5.2% and 7.6% respectively over the year due to the effect of the pandemic. This confirms my statement last year that we have reverted to a GDP level of 2018-19, more or less pre-COVID. Growing things forward in this year to the last financial year, which is the year 21-22, we opened up the economy in the faulting way that we were best able to achieve, and against continuing restrictions elsewhere, not least in our principal markets of the UK and Spain. Our reopening involved a series of difficult measures, but I'm sure that everyone is now delighted to see Main Street beginning to fill out with tourists visiting on land-based tourist or from places. This has always been an important part of our economic activity. We have been blessed that we took the right decisions in saying not falling these functions and the associated staff by keeping full employment for work not fully functioning. The result is that we have been able to ramp up our airport, Sea Final Terminal and Coach Park without the disruptions that many other places have experienced. As lockdowns and travel restrictions ended during 2021, the result is that our forecast GDP for 2021-22 is for 2.59 million, surpassing the pre-pandemic GDP level. The good news of this data is that this GDP bounce back reflects that economic activity is coming back and shows that our economy is strong. It is our public finances that we now need to be much effective at. The GDP bounce back represents an increase of 173 million or 7.2% in nominal terms under the final estimate for 2021. But because this is a solid performance for a year where the economy opened up as early as possible, not from jump and start, but as early as we could. Real growth, however, increased marginally by 1.4% as inflation grew at a faster rate, rising by 7.6% over the year to 2022. The gross trading profit of companies grew by 10.5% over the year, and income from employment increased more slowly by 3.6% as the number of employees rose by 3% over the year, but real average annual earnings fell by minus 4.6% compared to 2020. Although there was significant growth in 2021, the total number of employee jobs remained just below pre-pandemic levels, with a small shortfall of 200 or 0.7% compared with October 2019. The numbers show we went from 30,603 jobs at the peak in 2019 to 20,403 jobs in October 2021, growing from a figure of all employing jobs of 29,516 in October 2020, when we were at peak pandemic. Hopefully, this is that we can also see that the growth in jobs is coming in, hopefully, we can also see this because the growth in jobs is coming in the private sector. For in the period from October 20 to October 21, the growth in private sector jobs was 851, or 3.7% up to 23,638. And only a growth of 47 in the public sector. In the financial services sector, we have seen jobs reduced only by 25 out of 4,027 in the past year, up 29% over a quarter, and almost a third from when we took over in 2011. The speaking of that, the FATF decision is one which will impact the sector, but we do not believe it will impact jobs. We respect the FATF decision and will be working to resolve the matters identified. We do not believe that Gibraltar deserves to be anything other than rightlessly, and will work with the industry and law enforcement, as well as with the FATF itself, to ensure our view is shared by them in time for the next review day. Employment, Mr. Speaker, Germany has remained stable and Gibraltar continues to benefit from admirably low unemployment levels, even during such difficult times. We also continue to see record low unemployment, in fact. In 2021, whilst the pandemic critically affected unemployment throughout the globe, the yearly average for Gibraltarians registered unemployed was 27. The comparable figure for 2011 was 442. That represents a drop of 415 unemployed from the time that we took over. A staggering 94% reduction in unemployment since our election of 2011, something of which we are rightly proud. That is not misnomer, Mr. Speaker. Not all. In 2022, we have continued to maintain low employment levels, with first quarter averages for 23 of registered unemployment at 41. A comparable figure for the first quarter of 2012, when we took over from then, was 522. There's a drop of 481 there, a 92% reduction in unemployment since the first quarter of 2012. We are not really pleased to note that as of May 2022, unemployment stands at 35. The fact is that we will agree that daily life has hardly been normal throughout the year, given other places opened up in different ways with different requirements and the other challenges we have faced. If we take the average year on the economic growth between 2014 and 2018, the 5 years pre-pandemic, this average amounts to 10.7% growth, despite the lower than average increase in 1890, for the reasons I explained, which were associated with revenue loss within the gaming sector of one company to our company. Mr. Speaker, taking these figures absolutely, the forecast figure now is £21 million higher than in the final estimate of the 1920 GDP figure. That is what was only marginally affected by COVID, so what I would surmise is that we are back on track having lost 2 years of economic growth. This, in my view, would be consistent with what the men in the street may feel, that somehow about 2 years of all of our lives would be lost to the pandemic. Mr. Speaker, interestingly, the ratio of personal taxation to GDP has been consistently coming down in Gibraltar. The ratio was 13.5% when we took over, with a GDP of 1.082 billion. And £146 million in total collected in total goods at 24.1 million and personal tax at 122.5 million. Today, the ratio after 10 years of socialist Liberal government is 5% lower, and we're one third lower at 8.7%, with a total of 225.6 million in total collected in social insurance, at 45.6 million, and personal tax at 180 million. The GDP to tax ratio in the United Kingdom in March 2022 is 32.7%. That is 73.4% higher than Gibraltar. The GDP to tax ratio in Spain at the end of 2021 is 76.6%. 76% higher than in Gibraltar. These figures show that the remarkable increases in government revenue in our time in office have not been driven by taxation, as we have relied on external arrivals and our external market to raise revenue. That is the market in which the pandemic caused havoc, arrivals from outside. It is returning, Mr. Speaker, albeit more slowly than they would all have wished. Mr. Speaker, I would ask you to explain how the GDP impacts on the rest of the government finances. I also seek to explain the steps I feel we must take to somehow bridge the gap and bring the state of the government finances back on track after a serious extended period is assisted by external forces. Given all the usual caveats, I will also this year not have to do the GDP per capita calculation for Gibraltar, as the figures will be the same for the year 1920. Mr. Speaker, as I mentioned in last year's speech, the exodus book format took on a much more complex nature to be able to turn a track COVID-related expenditure separately from other annual recurring expenditure. This year, the exodus book has necessarily had to conform to that format. But I don't know, I was trying to distill at a high level the contents of those 3,300 pages, which set out in great detail how government finances is much up to expectation and where I think we are heading over the next 4 months. The spirit of transparency and to provide the most complete accountability to our people, we have taken the previously unprecedented step of publishing the estimates book online as I rose to start the series. It will make this exercise easier for the public to follow as they listen to the deliberations of this House. The link to the draft estimates book, which is this one, which was confidential until I had got up to speak this morning, is on the government press office page, our Twitter feed, and on our Facebook page. I have shared the links on my Facebook page also. I will therefore refer all those watching or listening who want to follow the economic part of this debate to please look at the estimates book as we go through the next section. Additionally, earlier estimates books will all soon be made available online also to enable all citizens to track the economic evolution of our community over the past 50 years. To make my references easier to follow, and at the risk of sounding like good news, thinkable, but without the assistance of a realtor, I will refer to relevant page numbers of the book during the speech so that those following can find the relevant information. In doing so, Mr. Speaker, I will sound a cautionary warning. If COVID and lockdown had an impact for the economy and created uncertainty, inflation and world events continue to cause pressure and uncertainty that make charting the next 12 months as fraught as it was to predict them some 12 months ago. Never has the word estimates been more appropriate, Mr. Speaker, than in the title page of this book. Mr. Speaker, let me turn first to the year that has just closed. A background and context to financial year 2021-22 was that while we lifted restrictions fairly quickly, many countries, including the United Kingdom and Spain, continued with restrictions for longer than we expected when we compiled the instruments for in the first few months of 2021. These restrictions were not in the form of a complete lockdown, but they nonetheless discouraged international travel generally, although we received visitors from the UK, and impacted on visitors, all of which have had an impact on many of government's revenue sources. At a high level, Mr. Speaker, we were projecting a loss for 2021-22 of £50.72 million. As I've already made public, on first becoming aware of the figure, the forecast outturn deficit for the year was slightly higher than that, at £55.291 by some £4.6 million. People can see that on page 2 of the estimates book. Although the figures in the book are kept confidential until the start of this debate, it would then have been fair for me not to respond that figure with the public as soon as we became aware of it in the Ministry of Finance and the Treasury. That is our commitment to being fully accountable to our people. Mr. Speaker, let me see if I can break this down into more relevant analysis for those listening to understand. The good news in all of that is that our true third-party revenue came in at £650 million, that is, from £16 million above our projected revenue of £634 million. This shows that government revenue streams, by and large, held up despite the after-effects of the prolonged restriction, and as you can see that on page 5, which is a B page. Personal tax and corporate tax came in some £22 million overall in excess of our projection. That's on page 6, Mr. Speaker. Import duties, on the other hand, came in at a disappointing £111 million, when our conservative estimate, also on page 6, called for £150 million. This can be explained given the lack of tourists and the mandatory issues to make local shopping more attractive. When we have seen, Mr. Speaker, when we have been used to collecting close to £170 million in duty, a hit of around £60 million, or around 10% of our COVID income, is very noticeable indeed, and the reason that the COVID response fund has had to step in to make up the difference. But I will say more about that shortly. Stamp duty, which you can also see from page 6, Mr. Speaker, came in at £14.9 million, almost double the predicted estimate of 8.5 million, signifying the continued strengthening of the resilience of the property market. The existing revenue was actually down, and to an extent, this was in part compensated for by the higher fees earned on our upper lock tourist site. The GAQ group purchase rental scheme revenue came in some £10 million ahead of our estimate at £56 million, and that's on page 9 of the speaker. This is directly in line with the result of the increases in social insurance, which were announced after the publication of the recent book, and therefore had not been factored into it. The revenue from increasing the electricity tariff was also reflected that this came in some £2.75 million higher than we expected. The market leader port produced some revenue almost in line with expectations, some £650,000 down, earlier on the estimate, despite the reduction in crew by activity, which can be seen on page 10 of the video. With minor exceptions, income is therefore broadly in line with our estimates, and that can be seen in pages 6 to 10, which I just taken the house through. The positive takeaway from this analysis is that while we introduced measures that were not projected at the time of preparation of the estimates book, such as increases in social insurance or electricity, they actually gave rise to increases in that particular head of revenue. These were not offset by other losses within that same revenue head as might have been expected, for example, had a spate of redundancy followed from the release of restrictions. But on the expenditure side, I believe we managed reasonably well also. We projected for consolidated fund charges of £103.4 million, and the forecast outturn figure came in at £105.7 million, that's on page 13. Most of this difference is made up of £300,000 of additional legal aid paid, circa £800,000 of social insurance contributions arising from the increase, and an additional repayment of tax of £800,000, and that was the figure. Can be seen from page 16 of the detailed estimates for the recurring fund charges. Similarly, the figure was projected 551 of departmental expenditure, and the forecast outturn came in at £569 million, which is a difference of £18 million, or some 3%, and that is visible, Mr. Speaker, in summary in page 14 of the book. Which is a thundering overhead expenditure. The real cause of this figure is not unexpected, with a £20 million overspend between the GHA, the ERF, and the care agencies, all areas of expenditure, which have had a significant and unpredictable overspend and been critical to return to business as usual and emerge from COVID. The Department of Education came in over budget at £61.4 million when compared with £58.8 million estimated for. The main reason for the overspend has been the larger forward temporary cover, which has been addressed recently by the formalisation approach that needed to be filled, and was resulted in the increase in post from 869 to 1,123, or a whopping 30% increase in post, Mr. Speaker. This is not increased expenditure, though, as we were already simply regularizing posts that were previously funded through temporary assistance expenses charge. The GEA is another authority, and so if you think about it's on pages 32 and 61, that people can see the detail of that spending effective of the day. I did not increase expenditure, as I said. The GEA is another authority which is coming at higher than expected cost, 67.9 million, as compared with an estimate of 55 million. That can be seen on page 14. The reason for this overspend is the inability to do away with the temporary generator within the timeline that we had hoped for as commissioning continues on the new plant, coupled with the inflationary impact on fuel costs. The good news on the former, though, is that we are working to take things offline and fuel costs. On the latter, however, the recent increase in fuel prices will no doubt impact on the year ahead, well beyond what was possible to project earlier this year when the estimates book was being prepared. As a speaker, in that respect, because the GEA is an authority, people will need to go to one of the vendors who wants to go to page 248 to see the detail of the payments that I have just referred to. I'll say a little more about the GEA. For now, we'll think that we expect an overspend presented an unexpected increase in the cost of fuel. Again,
by and large,
all other departments fell within the boundaries of their estimates, with the usual swings and roundabouts between departments, as one department's overspend was compensated for by another department. Similarly, the best thing that the speaker involves a summary of this is a summary of consolidated fund expenditures, which is in pages 13 and 14 of the book. Finally, we continue to other expenditures in the greater fund. Looking for that, the area of expenditure that was most prone to error than projected, given the huge uncertainty at the time of declaration of the estimates last year. It was not that we could ask questions on determining how long COVID would exist, but also the implications of elements such as how other countries are going to react, what tests are required and what attitude would be taken for employees of key facilities such as the hospital that had been assisting of all staff with all the associated impact on cost. What we saw here was expenditure far in excess of the amounts we projected. Our estimate last year was for a COVID response fund expenditure of £57.5 million. Whereas the forecast outcome turned out slightly in excess of double this amount at £135.1 million. The detail of this figure is on page 292, which is near the back of the book, where we have appendix F, the COVID response fund. It's worth the figure to do an analysis of this, because the main reasons for that overspend can be broken down, and trying to follow the book, Mr. Speaker, need to be on page 292 of our budget analysis. There wasn't a large underestimation of how actual revenue would hold up when compared with the average revenue collected by government for each of the 17 heads of revenue compared with the equivalent revenue for the same heads for the 2 years pre-pandemic. By and large, our estimates were broadly in line with expectations, both for, first, the head of rates, which is easily explained, we provided an exemption for rates for a quarter beyond what we had originally projected, and, most importantly, for import duties, which for the reasons explained meant that there were no tourists coming to Gibraltar, the visitor numbers were low, and the import duties were driven by the arrivals in Gibraltar who buy things in Gibraltar. That figure came in at £45.7 million below the adjustment we expected we would need to make. In addition, our COVID cost for the GAK and other public undertakings came in at £22.8 million, which was 15.8 or 3 times more than what was originally projected. Mr. Speaker, as you know, the COVID response fund is entirely funded by government borrowing, deficit, by borrowing. The effect of this additional £68 million of expenditure was that the government needed to borrow further, therefore. As we have expected borrowing to increase this year by £50 million, it has actually been required to increase by £100 million. And that can be seen on page 11 of the estimate. Which sets out how the borrowing can be at the bottom of the public debt. I trust this explains the position and also seems to interconnect the different items and threads in the instruments for all members and for everyone in the community who may be listening to or watching this video. Mr. Speaker, over the last few months, there has been an attempt to suggest a division between comments made by the father of the house and then also the UNDPC, where he projected a loss of an excess of £90 million and some of the statements by the member. Double the father of the house was guiding his projections for the overall loss based on the level of borrowing without specifying the distinction between business as usual losses of £5.3 million and the additional over expenditure incurred within the COVID response fund. Mr. Speaker, I trust this letter provided seems to reconcile any perceived differences, as in fact there were and are none. Indeed, I would strongly recommend a thorough read and analysis of the estimate book, which provides all relevant information in this respect. I will now seek to set out where I think public finances are heading over the next 12 months. As I said previously, there continue to be very strong external headwinds that make projecting this extremely difficult. But we must, of course, try to produce an accurate estimate. lockdown and lack of tools in Europe. The hindrance caused by the impact of the war in Ukraine, the global turmoil and realignment, the impact on availability and prices that there have resulted in all governments developing years of low interest to introduce repeated increases in interest rates that many of the young in our community will find unprecedented. The impact on costs, and we simply cannot avoid such costs like the price of fuel to power our community or to desalinate our water supply, or to fill the trucks that delivers produce to our supermarket. Where all this will eventually settle and what it means is difficult to project. All I can say is that day by day, the prognosis is for increasing costs. Our projection of these possible increases back in March 2022 seems modest now, as we've seen the rapid rate of change and increases in inflation. The impact on all of us in similar ways, devaluing the pound in our pocket and making us feel grateful that there is availability of the product we may seek to acquire. We highlight some of the challenges in delivering a program of work when it is not just price that one is grappling with, but availability and impact that's in them. Once again, Mr. Speaker, I remind the House of my earlier comments that these issues are not of our making. The only difference in the effect of this is that most of us do not have to seek to project where we are, heading in a way that is so challenging that it was most likely wrong from the moment in to drive and reassess for. These external forces are affecting all countries in different ways. We are no different. Nonetheless, Mr. Speaker, this is what we think will happen over the next 12 months in terms of the public finances. Mr. Speaker, those who want to follow the debate in the book, go back to page 1. We are estimating revenue for the year of 2022-23 of around 637, so 637 million. That would be some 12 million being the forecast starting for the year 2022. The reason for this is that it follows, and you can now go to page 6, which includes a great one. We have kept corporate and personal tax more or less in line with the estimate for the year that has closed, and we have not increased this figure in line with the forecast outcome, as we expect corporate tax returns coming in this year might be somewhat impacted by the effects of the lockdown. Remember that corporate tax returns are sometimes 18 months in a year. But because it must be noted that corporate tax returns are certainly trailing about a year and a half behind general activity. We have significantly reduced our estimate for import duty from the 150 million we estimated last year to 120 million. We are hopeful that now that the provision tariffs are on the up, that the forecast outcome for this year will be higher than this, but we think we should remain prudent and conservative in our prediction. I would comment, Mr. Speaker, that from the information I certainly have, that has been wise, because so far we are on target for the lower estimate of revenue than we would be for the higher. Mr. Speaker, in terms of expenditure, we are projecting consolidated fund charges at 99.4 million and departmental expenditure at 552.8 million, and that also is on page 1. The reasons for this are as follows. The consolidated fund charges factor in increases in our cost of borrowing, assuming an average interest rate during this financial year of 1.5%. It is possible that the average may well exceed this given recent announcements by the Bank of England that a more thoughtful approach may be taken to future rises to curb inflation. This recent change only serves to reinforce my comment on the possible accuracy of the assumptions we have made. The effect of increased borrowing costs is somewhat mitigated by challenging, channeling some of the excess costs through the sinking fund. Nonetheless, given the overall impact on liquidity, it is important to highlight. For departmental expenditure, this figure of 552.8 million is, of course, ambitious. It is £15.5 million down on the forecast outcome for the year just closed, and particularly in a period where inflationary increases were quite confined. That said, if we're able to rebalance our books as soon as possible and return to the fiscal discipline of meeting expenditure from revenue, we must be controlled and ambitious in that control. Let's take a quick review of the information on the estimate summary page, going back to page 1. Shows that we are expecting COVID response fund expenditure to scale up this year, hopefully finally. The budget for the fund is £40.12 million. The vast majority of expenditure relates to making contributions to foregone revenue. Once again, the majority year this being another quarter just as important. We have not budgeted for any departmental COVID-related expenditures, with the exception of £120,000 for elderly residential services. The reality of the situation is really proving a challenge, as there are invoices that are being received during the early months of this financial year that will inevitably relate to the COVID response fund for goods and services related to the last financial year. And the rest of the citizen controlled approach seeks to bring to an end expenditure under the COVID response fund, with concerned officers knowing they cannot incur any further spending under the excuse that it is COVID. Given the June treaty was the authority with the biggest and the highest COVID related expenditure, we have explained that where a resurgence to occur, we expect the cost of the necessary preparations and tests to be between £8 and £10 million. That has been provided for specifically in page 227 of Peter's answer to that page. If such expenditure were necessary, should there be, for example, a resurgence of COVID related cases, it will be available as money that can be tapped into, but it should not be incurred as otherwise. In this way, any such expenditure is instantly highlighted, and we can seek to understand why it is being incurred. It will not interfere with the run and flow of all the rest of the accounts of the future. The effect of all of the above results in a projected deficit for the current year of £45.3 million and an overall additional net borrowing of £50 million. The figure will come in around those figures, it will mean we are back on track and we have reset spending within acceptable levels without resorting to cuts in services or expenses. As we figure, we will finalise this year with our strategy for the repayment of the COVID debt, which will be long-term war bond style debt. Our current discussion with the most expensive is to a bulk of the outstanding over 25 to 26 years, with the benefit of the sovereign guarantee from the United Kingdom extending over that period for that ring-fence crystallised debt. We will be able to step back into legal agreement stone only once the full extent of our COVID drawdown is itself received. I think I turn now to the relevant areas of the material responsibility and the community. I think I'm going to start with the central area agreement. It is clear that the local economy is still adversely affected by the cumulative impact of the pandemic. The central area agreement, or CAU, is therefore being asked to continue to take a more conservative and prudent approach towards debtors and letting us still just survive the ever current economic crisis. Although businesses are now up and running and the tourist industry is now starting to recover, our economy is still recuperating from the aftermath of the pandemic. But whilst we do not want to put anyone over the edge at this time, it is also true that it would be unfair to take steps to increase revenue from everyone who pays and allow those who do not want to pay to continue not paying. Leniency in chasing government debt is therefore being shown only in respect of those who genuinely cannot pay. The second arrears unit in fact focuses mainly on the arrears recovery for the Commission of Income Tax, which is the principal receiver of revenue. We focus on compliance with arrears agreements and the recovery of arrears on a daily basis, using different methodologies and also actively ensuring that current payments are received in a timely manner. This is hugely important in delivering social justice, also, Mr. Speaker, as it is totally socially unjust for most to pay their dues and for some not to bother paying. For the central area unit managed to control and reduce the debt for individual tax, AYE, and social insurance, unfortunately, the corporate tax rate increased by 2.67 million from last year as a result of the economic difficulty being experienced by some businesses. Without the central area unit, that increase in debt would undoubtedly have been even greater. 1.8 million of this increase can be attributed to tax penalties that need to be recovered or written off as the case may be. These arise from a number of non-chargeable and non-accounting single-purpose companies that are not trading but remain active at companies' house and are therefore required to file annual returns. The figures below the registrar has the discretion to strike off the register the name of any company in respect to which the annual return has been filed for the previous 3 years. Should this do so, the prospect of recovering these official penalties becomes remote and they then need to be written off. Because you can imagine, the increase in corporate tax debt is largely to be expected, given the very difficult trading conditions arising from the lockdown and the wider COVID restrictions. The CAU continues to retain payments due to companies and businesses from the Hamas-led government and returned a total of 2.5 million during this year for both Palestinians and Israeli recovery. This is an incredibly effective tool whereby tax and other debts due to governments are settled by offsetting payments from the government for goods and services provided by the companies and businesses. The raising of objections for new business licenses and or extensions of licenses with regards to directly for companies continues to be a very effective tool for the speed of recovery of almost £500,000, £456,000 during this last financial year. The CAU has also successfully recovered over £108,000 with regards to a review for PAYE, electricity and gambling license fees as a direct result of dividends received from the producer. They have also raised objections to the company's house with regards to legal-defined companies and liquidations, reducing corporate tax by nearly £379,000. In addition, Mr. Speaker, the CAU undertakes fully respect to the Environment Department before the granting even of beach tent licenses, as individuals are required to settle all outstanding debts before the use of the flotation tent is approved. It's important, Mr. Speaker, to use every lever at the disposal of government to recover debt due to government, and I think the whole House will agree with this strategy, as we can't allow some to simply ignore their liability whilst the majority dutifully pays. And remember, Mr. Speaker, this is about those who won't pay, not those who cannot pay. In fact, Mr. Speaker, we've seen a number of agreements of the House in this respect in the past. Additionally, we do protect those who generally cannot pay because the ministry simply won't or don't pay. For the moment, Mr. Speaker, the CAU carry out full arrears checks for LPS and the assignment of units, and effectively recovered over £120,000 in respect of taxes with insurance, granted the assignment of just one unit from using this strategy. However, the arrears in the most important role in these two challenging years has been to maintain and control the overall arrears of revenue in the midst of the pandemic, where companies and individuals have been struggling to survive from one day to another. As all of the members will understand, as years go by, it becomes more challenging to recover historical debt, especially since the main bulk of the room has already been addressed by CAU during their first four operational years under our time in office, Mr. Speaker. The Federal Arrears Unit works closely with all government departments, agencies, and authorities to actively pursue and guide them with their debt recovery and to assist them with the preparation of write-offs for historical bad debt. Mr. Speaker, during the last year, the Federal Arrears Unit undertook thorough exercise to identify the bad debts where there was no prospect of recovery, as individuals and firm directors have passed away, linked to Gibraltar, and were deemed unconductive, uncontactable. All companies have been struck off the register or liquidated. The exercise was presented to the Financial Secretary, who approved write-offs amounting to over 4.85 million, of which 2.8 million pertains to tax and increased insurance, and 0.7 million pertains to general rents and sundry rents. The balance of 1.3 million related to transport, airport landing and departure taxes, hospital fees, import duties, services performed by the public offices, port arrival and departure taxes, and port operations and harbour craft licenses. The benefit of this exercise results in not just reducing the debt, but also thoroughly cleansing both the tax office and LPS agencies. Mr. Speaker, even though the pandemic has unfortunately cast long shadows on our economy, it is evident that the Federal Arrears Unit has been creative in their approach and has effectively and successfully managed to reduce the overall arrears of revenue by over 2.3 million in the pandemic period. Finally, let there be no doubt in anyone's mind that the Federal Arrears Unit shall continue to work diligently to restore fairness to our systems of chasing debt and deposit. As we begin now, I want to deal with the Civil Status and Registration Office in the country. In order to do so, Mr. Speaker, but not to delay the consideration by the House of the economic issues which concern us today, I will lay on the table an extract containing the relevant parts of my address today, which deals with the hugely important work of both these departments. In that way, the House will now have before it all relevant information about the running and progress of those departments, as well as the important statistical information which will be helpful to members. We can do that to all the honourable members. will then be able to continue with the cost of my speech distributed directly to the budgetary classes that the House is concerned with primarily to. And that paragraph 59 of my prepared text. It is a very specific that I now turn to the statement, given that the collection of corporate and personal income tax consistently accounts for approximately between 40% to 50% of recurring government revenue. As a very customary, I comment on this very vital part of our economy, highlighting developments in important areas in this field that are relevant to our country. The total amount of tax collected in 2021-2022 financial year is 324.6 million, representing 202.5 million in personal taxes and 122.1 million in corporate taxes. Because those who are following the book can see those numbers on page 6 of the book. That is 22.5 million pounds more in personal income tax. And £2.1 billion more in corporate tax than in the previous financial year 2020-2021. Despite this immediate net increase in revenue, the general expectation is that trends will start to decline as the eventual effect of the COVID pandemic is realized in the years to come. It is now more important than ever that we continue to exercise prudent financial management, ensuring that we successfully drive through these challenging times. That is the focus of the government. We are fully committed to ensuring the speedy return to the prosperity Gibraltarians always enjoy, to the life every Gibraltarian deserves, and to continuing to make Gibraltar the wonderful place that it is. This is the path that we have embarked upon. It is by no means an easy path, but I am confident, however, that this government has the necessary expertise and maturity to navigate these challenges, which, together with the public service, achieve the desired and deserving outcome for us. Our true desire for management is evident in the way that we have forecast future tax receipts. Our financial estimate for the 2022-23 financial year is projecting a receipt of 307.6 million, ensuring that any potential impact from external factors such as Brexit or the lasting effect of the COVID-19 pandemic is suitably hedge-stricken. The speaker has in the past budget session highlighted the enormous investments made by my government in addressing the historic backlog of tax refunds owed to the public. In the extended financial year 1921, an unprecedented investment amounting to £26 million was allocated to tax refunds, ensuring that as many taxpayers as possible were repaid money due to them. Notwithstanding the careful and responsible approach that we have adopted regarding public spending, we have continued to allocate significant funds towards tax refunds with an amount of 18.8 million allocated in the financial year 21-22. Despite the difficulties that we're experiencing, it is right to give money back to taxpayers that is due to taxpayers as soon as possible. It is also better to put money back in people's pockets at a difficult time. That is not just the right thing to do. It is in line with the recommendations of the OECD on helpful measures for the public, helping them to cope with the pandemic. Become embarked by the Commission of Income Tax. But whilst the COVID-19 pandemic impacted anticipated progress in their refunds program, the Income Tax Office has now continued to update its refund position successfully. Currently, over half of the assessment refunds for 1920 and over one third of those for 2021 have now been completed. Completion in relation to the UAE will continue, and refunds will continue to be released in line with the funding of £10 million made available this financial year. I know that some criticism may have been levied against the Income Tax Office by some who have experienced delays in receiving these funds. I'm also aware that some have to wait longer than they would have liked in order for them to receive their refunds. Unfortunately, cash transfers had to be closed due to the COVID pandemic, and as a result, the payment of tax refunds is now carried out by a direct debit transfer. I believe that most people are content to receive their tax refunds as a payment. It's a more streamlined, and there's no requirement for physically queuing up at a counter, and no delays in clearing a check. It also allows for shorter processing time and for HM Treasury to effect payments too. It is important to understand the full number of applications received by the Income Tax Office. Most people in Gibraltar have not supplied these details, and therefore this continues to be a tremendous task, but one we are committed to in order to ensure that taxpayers receive their refunds
times quickly. Given that the information and data that is becoming indigenous in the future and will help to smooth out the efficiency of future refund payments by the Income Tax Office. The team at the Income Tax Office is working hard to give each citizen back what they are owed. They do not want to keep it. The government continues also, Mr. Speaker, with its commitment to tax transparency and prevention of waste evasion and profit shifting. As a member of the OECD's inclusive framework, Gibraltar has engaged in initiatives including the implementation of Pillars 1 and 2 relating to taxation of the digital economy, the allocation of tax rights and the harmonization of the minimum global tax rate, probably the most drastic change to modern taxation in recent times. The Commission on Income Tax and the capacity of competent authority of Gibraltar has continued to ensure that Gibraltar meets all international obligations under its various international change definitions in respect of both the automatic exchange of information and rapid change on request, including both the international tax agreement with Spain and the double taxation agreement with the UK. Gibraltar also continues to undergo numerous assessments as part of its membership with the inclusive framework on debt and for failures of all banks. Returning to a national focus, the Income Tax Office continues with its digital transformation in conjunction with the Majesty's Digital Services team. Last year, for the rollout of a preliminary tax e-form, I was sorry to see that the adoption of this service is not expected, with most taxpayers continuing to opt to file their returns either by email or even in paper form. We'll listen to criticism and complaints about the system. We'll listen to what citizens want and need, and we have worked hard to deliver what they deserve. A system for which we can easily register, one which is not cumbersome and is set out in a familiar format, and one which is not time consuming and which is dynamically responsive to requirements. As a result, both components of the tax return that need to be completed online are much simpler. I would like to express my sincere thanks to all the team at the Income Tax Office for all their hard work, dedication, and commitment. In doing so, I now turn to the measures that the government will implement in order to address the imbalance in our public finance and secure financial institutions. In last year, I announced an incentive intended to promote the investment in marketing by awarding businesses net investment in marketing an additional deduction amounting to 50% of their marketing costs. When we discussed this incentive internally, before the announcement, it was always intended to refer to marketing with Gibraltar as a destination and jurisdiction or to visit in which we set up business, and not a deduction to all marketing expenses generally. The idea of the incentive was that as we emerged from the pandemic, we wanted to encourage travelers to visit Gibraltar and businesses to consider relocating here, particularly now the case has been made improved for remote working. This is a way of adding to the government's main efforts of promoting Gibraltar by allowing and incentivizing businesses to join up in these efforts. We recognize that businesses sometimes have a difficult time to have a more effective way of delivering these objectives. That was the intention. However, it was not how it came across from the street for the legislation that followed. The specific incentive was intended for a period of 2 years. Following this announcement, we realized that this incentive is untested and capable of being overused by certain sectors of the economy that doesn't be drafted. When this combined with the speaker, I am terminating this incentive with immediate effect. Very good use has been made of this incentive, in large part because those businesses that might have used this heavily to market their to their customers are considerably delayed on their filing, something which in itself needs to be corrected, and I will deal with this shortly. It should also be noted that some businesses within this sector have brought the possibility of businesses to charge to our attention and told us they will not be in the position of this enhanced deduction. In order to treat everyone fairly, the incentive will therefore apply for its first and only years set out in the legislation, but only in the way it was originally intended. That is to say, the marketing must be of Gibraltar as a destination and jurisdiction with the aim of attracting conventions, events, business and tourists, or new businesses to set up with. Generic marketing to customers of one's own product is not what we have in mind and will not be allowed. The Income Tax Office will set out guidelines to define marketing in the context of the legislation. An amendment to the legislation will shortly be passed for a good principle. There has been much discussion and debate in other parliaments of the introduction of a windfall tax. I must admit, I find the principle of retrospective taxation challenging. However, I also recognize that these are difficult times which call for difficult measures. Many key and long-held principles have been set aside in countries' history of balancing their own books. Indeed, every day passes, it seems some announcement is made whereby the entire rule book is being rewritten on public finances beyond our shores. It will come as a surprise that we are looking at our corporate tax rate and how this is being split
between the various claims and sectors of the economy. What we have found is that certain sectors play their way in a balanced manner, whereas others are not meeting their end of the bargain. They are using all the creative tricks that are available to them, and in cases possibly extended the limits that were not expected to be possible, because they could make better than to grow. As I think I will not point these sectors out as it would be unfair, but rather I will tell them that I suggest we address this without resorting to a windfall tax which punishes everyone across the board. The speaker went into the open and amnesty period between now and the 31st of December 2022. All companies who have filed accounts during the COVID period, as this would be the last two financial years, should have filed accounts up to December 2022, and will be invited to voluntarily review their returns. If they consider they have underdeclared or put deductions in a way that might be considered overcreative, they will be allowed to resubmit these returns and pay the corresponding taxation without penalty, interest, or further questions. At the same time, we are conducting a review of these companies that we consider are being overcleared, created, and underdeclared. But the speaker needs to note that in doing this, we have reached out to our contacts at Financial Treasury to fulfill a secondment who will assist us with this process. After the end of the amnesty window on the 1st of January 2022, still within this financial year, the Commissioner of Income Tax will then issue estimated assessments on those companies where we believe there has been an underdeclaration for the years in question. The tax in this case will be a multiple to be determined of the taxation they would otherwise have paid. There will also be penalties and interest charges. Mr. Speaker, and Gibraltar has clearly taken a friendly and open view to operators in respect of their corporate tax, always seeking to incentivize and prioritize businesses and make the jurisdiction attractive and fair. In this regard, our officials are approachable and tend to take a balanced view when applying our tax position. I do not intend that to change, but ask operators to reciprocate and to treat the jurisdiction correctly and fairly too. The last 2 years have been exceedingly tough. We believe that as a government, we have enabled businesses to continue to thrive despite the unprecedented challenges. It is therefore a little too much when there is a feeling that that generosity of spirit is being somewhat taken for granted and abused. The bigger world is changing. Going forward, international businesses that set up here and do not pay taxes will be paying the correct amount of tax elsewhere anyway. So these operators are depriving this jurisdiction of tax for no net benefit. We must therefore instill in them correct tax behavior at this early stage. Their underdeclaring here needs to stop, and we intend to tackle it in the next 12 months going back to earlier financial year. As a figure, we will move to the next legislation to deal with this, and this will follow after the step. As a figure, over 30 years ago, the government entered into a series of agreements to privatize the production of water, the maintenance and operation of our water network, and waste water network. As part of a joint venture arrangement with the Lyonnais Group, a number of contracts were entered into between the joint venture entity, Lyonnais de Gaulle, Gibraltar Limited, and the Government of Gibraltar, whereby the United Government of Gibraltar contributed our network and desalination plant. This model was similar to the model adopted in the creation of Gibraltar and telecommunications space. Lyonnais Group, a shareholder of joint venture entity, Lyonnais de Gaulle, Gibraltar Limited, brought in their expertise. In this way, the joint venture we now know as Aquagen Limited was established. The operation of maintenance contracts were originally for a period of 30 years, with the possibility of extending it further for 10 years. Mr. Speaker, this contract expired on the 30th of June 2021, and given the other pressures facing government at that time, it was agreed to extend it for a short period, such that discussions could take place between the government and commercial solutions, limited known as Northumbrian Water, as expected to the university. The nature of the agreement was that if the contracts were not renewed, the respective assets held in equity would be returned to the government. Clearly, it was not practical to unwind equity given the implications of that agreement. But Speaker, the government has therefore agreed to take equity back into public ownership. 30 years ago, it was right to find a partner to push our water production forward and benefit from its firm expertise. Today, it is right that we should re-nationalize our water supply and buy-in expertise when and where we need it. But the benefit of
resource production companies and no return to the taxpayer in time. We will therefore purchase the shares in equity for the proportionate net asset value of the based around the related financial statements and calculations subject to any adjustments that may be required. By transferring the shares as opposed to allowing the contract to reach their natural conclusion, it is possible to avoid numerous problems such as having to set up a new entity with all the implications of formulation of agreement, customers, creditors, banks, and other important and most importantly, the employees of the company. The proposed approach of acquiring the shares in the way proposed means nothing changes. The specific accounts are being audited and completed, and it is therefore not possible to provide the exact cost of the acquisition at this stage. These will be subject to negotiation, of course, before finalizing the purchase price. Although discussions and negotiations are advanced, the rules are yet to be finalized within the process. The speaker has agreed to say the government would expect to finalize this transaction within the next 6 months, which will ownership will return fully to the Gibraltar government and control and our control in the course of this financial year. Mr. Speaker, as all honourable members will know, the GSD, when government, entered into a structured finance agreement to purchase in time the pickup cost of the Burnham property. Mr. Speaker, we in this finding itself have been vocal critics of that agreement. Indeed, the former leader of the GSD, Mr. Peter, has himself been consistently critical of this arrangement entered into by the government of the former leader of the GSD and current leader of the GSD, Mr. Stoller. To put it in perspective, an arrangement entered into by the GSD in 2003 for a total value of £54 million will by the end of this year have cost the taxpayer a total sum of £91.3 million, leaving an additional amount of around £17.8 million. That is the same figure, going well into over £100 million of cost for £54 million. The total amount is £109.1 million, assuming we pay the full off now. It will be even more if we continue the GSD arrangement. This agreement offered a break clause given interest rate swap maturity so long as certain filings are completed by the 11th of July 2022. These filings would allow the government to act as agent in the sale of the hospital building. The arrangement provides for a reduction of around £825,000 by way of rebate if this occurs in the future. I can confirm that the government is in discussions with Royal Bank of Scotland International to take advantage of this ability to terminate that sale and leaseback agreement, and instead of brokering a sale with a third party, confirm we, the government, will be purchasing the hospital ourselves. This will substitute the present sale and leaseback arrangement for the short-term financing that best settles away from that bank of the hospital back to the government of the GHA. Remember that at the moment, the structure that NatWest owns the hospital institute. While terms have not yet been finalized, to put this into perspective, we are currently paying a rent to a bank of almost £5 million per annum as a result of the arrangement entered into by members of the hospital. That is best seen on page 226 of the estimates book, which sets out the detail of that. The new arrangement we propose would allow us to repay fully the hospital loan over 10 years for an annual payment instead of £1.9 million. That would represent the figure of saving of an additional £3.1 million per year, £3.1 million per year less than the arrangement they entered into that can be spent on healthcare by taking advantage of the situation. There are, of course, numerous alternatives for that final agreement which we are considering. The speaker, if we decide to repay the facility more promptly, an alternative would be to increase the payment to, say, for example, £3 million per annum, again, less than the £5 million that they run by the school in rent, which again frees up £2 million for further healthcare and will allow us to repay the loan in our next annual. These interest figures have been projected, of course, with the current rate of interest in mind. Whilst we expect interest rates to rise, we need on the left field to construct a deal which will be much more beneficial to the taxpayer and the patients that use the VHA from the current deal done by the GSD and which we have been locked into, and that Mr. Peter and we have rightly been critical of this deal.
in order to ensure that we do simple justice, one of the things that the project must also do is insulate the most vulnerable from the effects of rampant inflation and the increased cost of living. So who are the most vulnerable, and how will they be protected by this project? First of all, we must agree that vulnerability for the purposes of this discussion is economic vulnerability. Secondly, the key factors of economic vulnerability are earnings and dependence on state benefits and payments. In this future, we will be ensuring that those on the minimum wage, those on disability benefits, and the recipients of the state or old age pension will all enjoy the benefits of increases in line with inflation to the payments that they will receive. I will take each of those in turn to announce the relevant increases that this budget will provide for the public. Mr. Speaker, the minimum wage will increase in line with our estimate of inflation at a rate of 8%. The minimum wage will therefore increase by 60p to £8.10 per hour. The government considers that this is the best way to ensure the minimum sum of money that people earn in our economy keeps pace directly with the cost of living in our economy. Based on a 37.5-hour week, the minimum wage will go up from 14,681.25 to 15,855.75, an increase of £1,174.50. Also, on a 39-hour week, the minimum wage will go up from 15,268.50 to £16,499.98, an increase of £1,221.48. Those worse off in work will therefore enjoy the benefit of salary increases of in the region of £1,200. But people will not just see the minimum wage to boot off by inflation, as I said. The state pension and disability benefit will also go up by inflation, which, as I said, we expect to be in the region of 8%. It is right that the old age pension and disability benefits should go up by the rate of inflation in order to ensure that those who depend on these amounts are not affected adversely by the increase in the cost of living. There will also be an increase for occupational pensions from the government, which will increase by 2% in line with the provisions of Sections 6, 2, and 2A of the Pensions Increase Act. Those pensions have been increasing by 2% each year for the last 20 years, even in the years when inflation has been lower than 2%. They will also rise by that rate this year. Mr. Speaker, our public sector salaries have grown in Gibraltar even when in successive years they have not grown in the United Kingdom. We are one community with an aspiration for our community. In the past 12 years, we have exceeded parity in many ways. In most areas, public sector salaries in Gibraltar are now in the region of 40% above parity with a equivalent rate in the UK. That is not true of all areas, though. We will not tolerate, even in these difficult moments, that any public servant should fall below parity with a UK equivalent officer, because we remain committed to parity with the UK public sector. We are therefore prepared to borrow more, if necessary, to fund public sector pay rises for any grades that might fall below UK parity analogue. In addition, and in any event, we will resume the annual pay rises for the public sector as our revenue recovers, or the overall cost of the public sector payroll comes down as a result of efficiency measures taking effect. Our public sector deserves nothing less, and we repeat our commitment to it and to the complement of the civil service at the time of our election in December 2018. In terms of the services provided by the public service, from the 1st of July, all fees charged by any government department and payable to government, including licenses and forms, will increase in line with inflation, rounded off to the nearest half point and to the nearest 50 pence. Over the years, we have noticed a number of issues with the operation of the Category 2 regime, and we will seek to correct these as we now progress the development of that new successful regime. The figure in front of this concern is that the regime works well when individuals join and stay in Gibraltar. One of the things that we have noticed, however, is that as individuals decide to leave, they sometimes fail to adequately settle their final tax positions from the department. This means that their final period in Gibraltar can, in some instances, go untaxed. This arises when the authorities seek to raise the amount of
the individual is saying, I'll get into water, and it's very difficult to locate them, let alone get them to suffer the amount it's taken to or enforce them out of that respect. I think a little about that was speaking of talking about the central reality, not being able to understand people who have not paid their taxes and never activated. In order to resolve this concern, we're going to require existing principles to individuals, test from the year, to pay the year's tax in advance. This will be effective for the tax year commencing on the 1st of July 2022, and the amount will be based on the maximum amount of tax payable under the decision. This will be settled by the 30th of November this year, which is the date by when they are obliged to file their return together with their annual balance payment of taxation for the year just passed in June. This payment in advance will be returned to them if or when they finally decide to leave, and any overpayments will be credited or rebated if appropriate. In this way, the final amount due on the year of departure can be settled correctly and will not end up having to chase individuals outside Gibraltar with varying degrees of success. But the fee of the pool will also apply to new applicants who will be asked to pay a year upfront on confirmation of this case. But the people will believe that all individuals were cared for very well during the COVID pandemic in Gibraltar, and it is therefore necessary for us to look to all our taxpayers, amongst others, for ways to recover the amount spent. Category 2 individuals are perhaps the wealthiest in our community. In this regard, we propose to increase the bond limits, such that the maximum accessible income increases to £118,000, up from £105,000. This results in an additional amount of tax of £5,000 being payable at the maximum income level. The minimum amount of taxation will also increase by £5,000 from £32,000 to £37,000. This will be used as a small increase to balance the benefit of the safety and relative freedom of living in Gibraltar, which has been granted to them during the most difficult times of the pandemic, as it has to all of us. The people have also noticed another trend recently whereby certain individuals have given up their Category 2 status and others are coming to Gibraltar without any such status and nonetheless demanding them. This follows advice from certain quarters to assist that individual to remain resident in Gibraltar with all the benefits of that accrued, but not pay tax or make any other direct contribution to the government coffers. Now, the reason for this is that we're not tax many forms of income, and therefore some individuals have chosen to make Gibraltar their home without necessarily paying their rent. I feel that all members of the House will agree that this is neither fair nor equitable. To deal with this, we propose to introduce a tax where any non-Gibraltar resident who claims residence in Gibraltar or is resident in Gibraltar is not in possession of a tax fee or HECS certificate and is not in true third-party employment, that is to say, somebody who is here but is not making any contribution, will be taxed on their full savings income, including pension income, interest income, dividend income, and income from other passive sources. This approach is clearly intended as a penalty. When we use the register of occupation as a means to assist them to identify these individuals, I grant the Commissioner of Income Tax powers to address this issue. But the figure there would also be a simple way to address this amount for such individuals to rationalize their status by enabling them to apply for their tax status retrospectively, so long as they meet the eligibility criteria and pay any outstanding amount of tax. That means that they will be able to obtain the protection afforded to them and those sources of taxation by Category 2 status. In order to address the unfairness of them not having paid over what may possibly be a number of years, they will need to pay this extension at the maximum rate with no adjustment for lower rates of income for the years when they have not applied to. Similar to the provision of tax to individuals and seeking to square our public finances, we have looked at other relative unfairnesses in our tax system. One of the distinctions that has remained unaddressed is the way the personal tax rate introduced by members opposite when they were in government did for income in excess of £500,000, half a million pounds, under the gross income based system. I think our present reduced system, under the two system, the average tax rate for income up to £500,000 worked out at 25%. The rates become, in our view, simply unjust when you get beyond that point. It's not something we never lighted upon before, given that there are very few of us on those levels of income. Beyond down in the future, the rate drops to 18%. And below 700,000 pounds of income, the income is taxed at 5%. That means that the higher the overall income, the lower the overall average rate of taxation. That judicial method, Mr. Speaker, is not progressive, and it is not social justice. So, Mr. Speaker, what we look at the practice, someone declaring £1 million of income is taxed at 17.6%, while someone with an income of £30,000 gets an effective rate of 18.2%. That cannot be right. Mr. Speaker, this creates an anomaly whereby business owners and others are able to delay or defer payments, such as dividends or even consultancy fees, to a point where they are able to distribute accumulations in one go and avail themselves of a lower marginal rate of taxes. In order to address this phenomenon, the rate beyond £105,000 of income will from now on be a flat rate of tax, and subject to what I'm going to say in a few moments about tax rates generally, it would be 25%. This is a fair approach, whereby everyone will pay tax at the same rate, say those at the very lowest levels of income, that is to say less than £35,000, who pay at an average rate of just under 17%, and those on very low income, below the tax threshold, will pay zero. But like every country in the world, we're going through tough times that have impacted on our public finances and our levels of deficit and borrowing. This borrowing does not mean anything other than the public spending on COVID and the maintenance of our public sector salaries. Nothing matters, nothing extravagant. Whatever some may now say to try and spare their workers in having agreed our COVID spending. But the thing is, nonetheless, an incumbent on me and this government to seek to find a way to lead this community out of the deficit period, with the certainty that we can address the deficit built up during the COVID period and its aftermath. In order to do so, I therefore propose a number of temporary measures. This measure is for 2 years only, and taxpayers will restore after those 3 years for the expectation measures that will follow. Mr. Speaker, for the next 2 years only, all taxpayers in all governments under the allowance based system and the gross income based system will increase by 2 pence on the pound for those 3 years. That is a 2 year, 2% increase in taxation. That is to say, under DC banding, an individual paying tax under GIBS on income above £25,000 will be taxed at an average rate of 27%, not 25%. And below that level, the average rate will be just by 90%, not the aforementioned 17%. As I say, the method will apply only for 2 years, 24 months. But think, as we did last year, the government has decided not to levy tax on pensions. We gave careful consideration to the option, but on balance, we have determined it is possible to avoid doing so. Mr. Speaker, we believe this measure was largely to be expected in this committee, and will catch few right-thinking members of the community by surprise. The additional income recovered by this measure will allow us to fill in the revenue shortfall in the coming 2 years and make repayment of the amounts borrowed easier for the taxpayer. It would also assist us to crystallize our COVID-related borrowing in a window over a longer period and allow us to repay this in a managed way. So we have all lost 3 years of our lives to COVID. The government has been paying out for 2 years. But we have lost 2 years of revenue, thus paying out more than ever and more than we received. So now, for the next 2 years, we must get whole again. We must use the next 24 months to strengthen our public finances. It may likely just as UK EU, but it may only last 4 years. So we will have to be strong at the least in 4 years, Mr. Speaker. The budget measure we impose not out of desire, but out of necessity, to get our public finances back on their feet in 2 years. So that's not careful to go and want to remain as low as possible. That is why we are fixing this measure for a short and defined period, so that people will have the certainty of how long they will pay this extra amount. Given that activity to tax breaches we've seen in other countries, and increases being seen in direct and indirect taxes in other economies, this is a modest method which will be much less painful than it will be useful in the rebuilding of our public finances post-COVID. The simplification is the lifeblood of any modern government and is vital to the continued prosperity and growth of any economy. In order to ensure that taxes are duly paid, it is vital to enforce tax compliance. Compliance is not an ugly word. It simply means that each of us should contribute what is owed in a fair and timely manner so that this can be invested in the benefit of all. It is therefore imperative that tax systems have robust and practical tax compliance measures. Unfortunately, the current structures we have in Gibraltar in place are outdated and in some cases simply not fit for purpose. Tax penalties will penalize those that blatantly claw down on victims while simultaneously acting as a deterrent to others from doing the same. In seeking to improve this, I have already asked the Commission of Income Tax to carry out a review of existing penalty regimes and seek alternatives that implement stricter but fairer penalties, ones that are commensurate with the size of the defaulter as well as the level and frequency of the default itself. These revised sanctions will be shortly introduced and will seek to create a noticeable improvement in general tax compliance and behavior. Presently, the Income Tax Office receives numerous applications for certificates and other information requests ranging from ordinary resume and subcontracting certificates to document transaction printouts as well as copies of previous filings and associated documentation. Whilst the team at the Tax Office are proficient in expediting these service requests to the best of their ability, the large volume of requests at particularly critical times for the fiscal year impose a notable administrative burden and corresponding cost for the department, which, up until now, has been absorbed as part of continuing operations. Certificates confirming ordinary residents are sought to justify requirements from partial financial institutions as part of the due diligence and self-certification process governed by obligations imposed by regulations for the Institute of Financial Accounting for Mexican jurisdiction, or to provide additional evidence of tax residence in Gibraltar in response to a tax residence charge or inquiry from a foreign jurisdiction. Subcontractors typically support by those seeking to avoid any provision of the 25% withholding tax being applied on payments received from their main contractor in accordance with the income tax, contrasting subcontractor regulations 1994. In order to alleviate the administrative burden referred to above, with effect on the 1st of September 2020, the income tax office will in turn have reason to cease from provision of these services. The tariff sheet will be made publicly available by the income tax office. Following the change in corporate tax rate from 10 to 12.5% on the 1st of August 2021, the income tax office will receive a representation from industry activities that the legislation is not sufficiently prescriptive in providing a basis for the additional year continuing the change in tax rate is to be computed. Although we believe this is clear, in order to accommodate industry requests, an amendment to the Breach of Tax Rules 1989 is being published. In addition to this, the income tax office is also issuing explanatory notes supplementing this legislative amendment. Section 30 of the Income Tax Act 2010 provides for a threshold in the possible income above which corporate tax returns must be accompanied by audited accounts. The threshold presently stands at £1.25 million. In order to assist our auditing practitioners, and particularly those in smaller firms, this threshold is being increased from £1.25 million to £1.5 million. We understand this increase will expand the company's scope of this audit invention, with approximately 5% of companies filing chargeable returns with the income tax office now benefiting from the exemption. This increased threshold will apply to accounting periods ending on or after the 1st of July 2022. The Speaker will be introducing a regulation making power in Section 30 of the Income Tax Act 2010, which will allow us to make the necessary changes to the threshold explicitly and responsibly without the need to seek the amendment of primary legislation in Parliament in the future. The bigger nonetheless urge practitioners and company directors themselves to ensure that the quality of accounting records and accounts will be maintained, and that the increase in this threshold we have announced today is not used as an excuse to disclose improper or incorrect returns to the income tax office. If we find that the quality of non-audited accounts is lacking, we will reverse this measure. But I think, by and large, most companies in Gibraltar somehow benefited from the approach we took in COVID. If the company was operational with a large workforce, they received support for their staff and reduced elements of rates and other charges. If they are passive holding companies, their service providers directed and separated the procedures until they were able to operate and keep those companies compliant with the rules. It's therefore right and fair for the dispute to balance the government finances, but to also ask every company to make a small contribution, just as we've taken for a time-limited basis from personal taxpayers. Several individuals were seeking a COVID recovery charge for a period of 2 years only. We proposed that every company pay a COVID recovery charge of £25 per week over the next 2 years. This charge will be levied as part of the company's annual return collected by Company Health as of the 1st of August to allow companies the time to set their systems up to deal with it. Company Health will then pass this COVID recovery charge straight onto government with no deductions whatsoever. I turn now to input into this. In July 2020, in the first throes of the pandemic, we announced a series of measures designed to provide financial support to our businesses as they returned to work during that difficult period, and secondly, to stimulate and accelerate economic activity. These measures included an import duty waiver, which was introduced for all commercial imports coming out of certain commodities, such as excise tax. In addition to this, we later introduced a 10% flat rate of import duty to be levied on all customs imports over £25 in value, with this measure again not applying to key commodities. Both of these measures will be revoked with effect in 0 hours on the 29th of June. Private importations will now be charged at the import duty rate in place prior to the introduction of these measures in 2020, subject to the 25% minimum rule remaining. The waiver on commercial importations is previously meant to be in effect also at 0 hours on the 29th of June, tomorrow in particular. This means that duty will be charged as per the Integrated Tariff Regulations of 2017. The relevant gazette will be published during the course of today. But maybe you may recall that the Mexican government of Gibraltar introduced a charge to the tariff for petroleum products at the roadside petrol pump for motor vehicles only. This measure was aimed at helping our petrol station locally with an equivalent measure had been introduced in Spain. This did not apply to fuel for vessels or other public cars. This measure was meant to partly address the ever increasing price of fuel suffered at the petrol pump by the Mauritius and the Foyer. The equivalent measure has recently been extended in Spain. In order to ensure that our citizens do not feel the economic need to drive to Spain to fill up, I propose to extend the original measure here too, from its expiry date on the 30th of June 2022 to the 30th of September 2022. As we will keep fuel prices under review for the next quarter and make such announcements as may be necessary in coming months about this measure. Absent any further announcements, fuel duty will revert to its original non-discounted rate on the 1st of October 2022. To figure any individual taxpayer who installs a mechanism for the electric charging of a vehicle in their home or private parking space or garage, garage driver will be able to continue to deduct the first £2,000 of cost approved by the Commissioner of Income Tax against their tax liability. Either in tandem with measures to encourage the uptake of electric alternatives, we will be actively incentivizing the purchase of conventional fuel vehicles. Motors, fully fueled by diesel or petrol, will become prohibited imports as of the 1st of July 2023. These vehicles are polluting, they're causing lung diseases, and contribute to overall levels of temperature. The visibly 50% of currently active registered vehicles in Gibraltar are more than 10 years old. The market sees approximately 500 or 600 imports of new vehicles every year that do not meet their latest emissions standards. In order to prevent the market from continuing to be filled with older, new polluting vehicles, new passenger cars, other than classic cars, light commercial vehicles, and buses over 5 years old will become prohibited imports from the 1st of January 2023. Tourism is one of the main areas of our economy, where we expect to see growth. We are excited to see it really before returning to pre-pandemic levels. The influx of visitors, however, places increased demands on our infrastructure and on our tourist products, such as our beaches and their nature. As such, government will be introducing a sustainable tourism tax, similar to that already payable in many destinations. This sort of showing that well-designed tourism taxes can be both practical and meaningful tools in the sustainable benefit of a destination's resources. As from the 1st of August this year, hotel and Airbnb visitors will therefore pay £3 per person per night for a stay in Gibraltar. All revenue from this hotel levy will be paid into the Climate Action Fund and will be invested into relevant projects such as promoting sustainable mobility and protecting and preserving our biodiversity. It will be the responsibility of each retailer and property owner to pass that cost on monthly to the Department of the Environment as the receiver of revenue. As of the 1st of April next year, transport passengers will pay £1 per passenger environmental levy based on the number of passengers on the vessel recorded. The sum will be paid to the port authority. As the figure we have seen in recent years, this meeting will be applied across the board. Nonetheless, the item that will be most noticeable to individuals will be the increase in the cost of fuel at the petrol pump, despite the reduction in duty we have granted and now extended to seek to mitigate the impact. These increases are really quite significant by any measure and are being felt across the globe, including in the US, which is an oil producer. This is, in fact, the principal driver of inflation across the world. You know the situation is severe when even citizens of the United States are complaining of the cost of putting up a tank of petrol. As you know, we have opted to produce our electricity that powers our homes and businesses to reduce the gas in the gas. The cost of gas is linked to the price of oil, and this is also increased with inflation. Not only that, Mr. Speaker, but to keep self-sufficiency, we desalinate our water supply, and this process is powered by electricity, which is ultimately powered by natural gas. As you know, we have recorded increases in IRPs here in Gibraltar between July last year, the time of our budget announcement in April this year, of 5.8%. I have no doubt, Mr. Speaker, that on recent CPI increases announced for May in the UK of over 9%, but by the time the end of the year comes, our own IRP will be closer to that figure. We consider that increases are likely to be in the order of 8%, and I've already said we will apply that figure to the minimum wage and pay pension and disability benefits. In light of this, we really need to pass on some of the costs of the increases we are suffering on the cost of producing electricity, which I referred to earlier, and I pointed out to the increases that we can see of cost in the book, which in turn is also used to produce water. As a result, we propose to increase electricity and water charges but contain that increase to 8% only. We are not applying the full increase in the cost of fuel to the consumer, far from it. We are greatly amortizing this increase to ensure it is less harsh than the reality of the market in which we are operating. We are going to provide more support in doing so than any other government is providing anywhere else in Europe. And we are doing this from a historic position of giving full amortization in a much, much more generous manner than is the case in the UK or Spain or any other economy. The growth of electricity prices are very significantly cheaper than the UK and Spain, our two most relevant comparisons. Compared against the prices paid by consumers in the UK, Gibraltar's average annual household electricity bill is approximately 30% lower. Spain has an average annual household electricity bill that is almost 40% more expensive than our own. Gibraltar's average household consumption is 4,013 kWh, which is quite high. This consumption is notably higher than the average consumption in the UK, which is 2,900 kWh, and Spain, which is 2,240 kWh. The reason for this is slightly twofold. The first is that each of the households can in some instances cooking in the UK and Spain is generally delivered by other means, normally gas heaters and boilers, and those are billed as cycles. But the speaker has also seen costs increase significantly, and they have not been incorporated to the price differential that I've already provided, so it is higher. Additionally, the higher cost often makes people more conscious of consumption electricity, something we all used to be in earlier times, we recall. But notwithstanding our higher household consumption, our electricity bills are still lower. If we calculate the annual household bills according to annual consumption by flexing volumes to equate things like for like, our bills would be approximately 50% lower than in the UK and even with the discount that has been announced in Spain and the financial support being provided from the UK. Take a look at the discounts which have recently been announced in Spain and the UK, the discount will be more than 50%. Indeed, the figure of 5,000 financial support itself is necessary in this jurisdiction. Consumers, of course, have not been able to find out what the electricity tax cut, of the human family in the UK. And here, existing projects have been expecting to Gibraltar since 1984 until 2010 under the JFP, which is starting to put them up. Our consumers are not exposed to regular price fluctuations based on fuel prices, as most of not of all European consumers are. Here, the unit price has remained constant for the past 12 months, and before then it had been constant for 11 years. This is because I think people cannot admit that in Spain and in the United Kingdom, and the wood bulletins that most people will be seeing, there have been constant references this year to how the price of electricity has changed almost on a weekly basis with the price of fuel has changed. That has not been the case in Gibraltar, but the price is fixed for you. And 80% increases that we are announcing today will be fixed for at least the next 4 months, and represent an increase to the average monthly bill of £4.37 or £1.09 a week. Mr. Speaker, thankfully for most people in our economy, that will be an imperceptible amount. This is approximately just over one third of the total increase suffered by our neighbours over the last 3 years alone, where they have seen an increase of €162 in quarter one of 2024. If you put all of this in context, the price of payment for diesel to run the central generators whilst they snag out the new power station has increased from 467.31 per metric tonne, as of the Friday of April 2021, to £1,022 per metric tonne, and as of the Friday of May 2022. In other words, an increase of 120% of cost to the taxpayer in diesel alone. For LNG, this has increased from £9.24 per metric million British thermal unit, as of the Friday of May 2021, to £15.79 per metric million British thermal units in May 2022, or an increase of some 71% in the period of 1 year alone. The figure of the increase in water electricity, which I have announced to apply, as from the August 2022 bill, and again, that will allow the DEA and aquifer to deal with billing issues, and will be accompanied by a weekly levy of £1 against each aquifer drinking millimetre to support infrastructure maintenance costs as we prepare to make greater investments in the distribution and management network of our water facilities. Going forward, Mr. Speaker, and building upon this continuing subsidy against the fuel price, hereafter, electricity and water tariffs will increase annually on the 1st of April by the cost of living percentage rounded down to the nearest million. That will be a considerable continuing discount against the fluctuation of the cost of fuel, whilst being a more manageable subsidy for future generations to sustain. And speaking of the event, there are people who find themselves in genuine difficulty, and for whom this increase might be meaningful, the government will introduce a means-tested utility credit, which will provide relief for genuine cases of hardship arising from this increase. No one will have their water or electricity cut off if they genuinely cannot afford to do. I will discuss the detail of this with relevant unions and representative organisations, including Action on Poverty, to ensure that we are able to protect the most vulnerable and that no one falls between the cracks. The figure of raising the cost of utility, even if it is by just over £1 a week, will obviously be unpopular, but most will not even feel this increase. But it will be unpopular with everyone. I just want to say this about that. I think that sitting in my chair at number 6 Queensway, having my responsibilities and seeing what I see from the great grid of instruments to Gibraltar, everyone in this house, every Gibraltarian, and every resident of Gibraltar would do the same thing. We have a right step to carry the truth, and by spreading the road amongst all who have taken the benefit of the measures, we are now paying back by protecting the most vulnerable. Because this is the right thing to do, even though it might be the most popular thing to do, Mr. Speaker. And I also recognize this, because the representation from employer and business representative organizations seeking no increases in respect of the cost of utilities. It is their job to make the case for their members, and I recognize that too. But if any member of the Chamber or Federation were in my chair, if our captains of industry were doing my job, they would be making the same decisions too. Yes, it might my offices around to the public sector and to public sector terms and conditions. So I think I will know this, because of me, and I defend the Gibraltar public sector and the role it plays in keeping the community working, as it did in stone fashion during the COVID pandemic. And our unions might think that they might borrow more to pay out more. And so they saw that in the medium and long term, there will be less jobs, less quality employment, and more years without services and pay rises, as well as even higher inflation. On reflection, Mr. Speaker, union leaders and business leaders would reach the same conclusions I am putting out to the nation today. I am absolutely sure of that. And they too would do what I am doing now. Because I'm doing these things to make the world strong for my children. I'm doing this to make the world strong for their children. I'm doing this to make the world stronger for all our children and our children's children. Not because we should do this, but because we need to do this. Actions taken out of necessity, not ideological choices or desires. Now, what we have done, Mr. Speaker, is both will be stronger than they ever been before. And Gibraltar will need to be stronger going forward, with a future relationship outside the EU, or rather with a future outside the EU, although hopefully a fully speaking relationship with it, but all commentators predicting a recession for next year, with a war in Eastern Europe which is no signs of abating and with attendant worldwide consequences. Speaker, I may be an optimist. I may believe Gibraltar has a bright future. Although this is all with high inflation and rising interest rate charges outside of our controls. But I know that our strong and bright future comes solely as a result of robust, tough measures now. When the pain gets tough, the tough get going, but always protecting the vulnerable. Taking a little more from those who cannot. Because the control has also repeatedly taught us the road to self-determination is paved by self-sufficiency. And in the end, Mr. Speaker, we are the ones elected to manage problems and to fix problems, not to exacerbate them. That is why we have to do what is done to create the patient and not fail to do so. It is incumbent on me now to thank the whole of the public service for the magnificent work that they do for the good. I see that genuinely and learn that they are often the butt of criticism. But the Gibraltar that we know and love cannot operate without our public sector's continued commitment. In particular, I thank the officers of the departments I have reported on and work directly under my ministerial responsibility. I would like to take a moment to thank you and the staff, in particular the clerk and the ushers, for all of the support given to all members of the House, myself in particular. A similar, of course, for specific mention, those who work daily with me at number 6 Monday. Assisting me in the discharge of my obligations in the post-mortem system. They are a very special bunch of people who are like mined through the butter of the daily challenges we face. My success, such as it may be, is down to them. But thank you for my office, I entirely admire. Of course, in this debate, so much of the preparatory work is done by the team from the Financial Services Office, the Finance Ministry, and the Treasury. I thank all who have helped us to prepare the essence. I still allow Babbage, Ernest, and Susie, as the Governor of the Financial Sector himself, spend most of the late winter and early spring in a permanent wrestling match with scissors and spreadsheets to produce the estimate. Your estimates are therefore as much my work as they are the work of the Financial Secretary of the Government, who are recognizing the House of Commons. As we have been with you, you are an essential part of how we have successfully negotiated the very challenging past 28 months since that first dreadful moment of March 2020. I cannot be fully enough in my gratitude on behalf of the people of Gibraltar for whom work alongside me in the Finance Ministry in the dark days of the dawning of the pandemic. This single judgment contribution is essential for the economic survival of the community. But this is not a zero budget, because there is nothing to give away. But neither is this an austerity budget, which would be a budget of cuts in the wholesale tax system that affects everyone in our economy in the same way. No, we will target support for those most in need. We will use this budget to deliver measures that will ensure that those worst off in our economy will not suffer in this year. No one in our economy will be left without enough money to buy the goods they need in their home. But our economy will not keep our people trying to change. Presumably, they understand the severity of the worldwide economic downturn, the complexity of the situation, and the reality of the argument about our public finances. Because Congress suggested there is no peaceful reason to vote as we continue to invest in the areas that require no worthy of our investment, not least our people, who will continue to progress with your funding points, etc. But to speak out of fact that our people gave me this job this past decade, not because it was easy, but because it was hard. And we are seeking these measures today, not because they are easy, but because they are right. That is why this will not be a budget for those who have more than enough, so that even more. Because today we must rebuild our public finances, not plunder them. The fact is that if we had not had the COVID-19 pandemic to deal with, we would today probably be announcing a $100 million surplus. If that were the case, we would not be announcing a tax rise. We have great challenges and allowances for the past 10 years. So people know our instinct is not to tax more. We are not taking these steps to court unpopularity. We are doing so because we have to, and we will do so only for a limited time. And of course, Mr. Speaker, the pandemic has affected many people, not just our finances. And as a result, the government expects that there are issues affecting services to citizens that we have to resolve. Is everyone happy? No. Do we need to do more in some areas? Yes. But let's be clear that we are failing to ask, there is a good and problematic reason, not negligence, laziness, or dereliction. And there is, of course, the effect of the pandemic and the effect of the rate of negotiation. Both those are slowly resolving some, and we expect to be able to do more to resolve outstanding issues. It will be difficult for people to hear. The tough part of this job is not being able to do everything that people would like you to do. So we're already borrowing quite a large amount of money. Borrowing more for our current expenditure would not make sense and would further breach our golden rule. We have to get back to observing the golden rule as soon as possible. So yes, there will be some benefits that are probably going to be unpopular. But these are the responsible and prudent things that we have to take. They are measures that will help us in the long term. But I'm not going to deviate from the long-term good just for some short-term popularity gain. That is not what people elected me to do. It is not what people entrusted me to do. Indeed, it is not why people trust us on this side of the house. Because we are the side of parents, pupils, pensioners, and pensioners in improving public services. And of course, we're also on the side of our public servants, who have shown that by prioritizing local care needs, but the efficient delivery of the public services themselves to those that need them is also a priority for my government. So to every young person, to every older person, to every person, to every vulnerable person, I see we are on your side. Your ambitions are our ambitions, your concerns are our concerns, your aspirations are our aspirations. As we remove the low rate of tax for those earning over £500 million, we are building also a new model of Gibraltar based on quality, fairness and opportunity, which is not based on class, wealth, or who you know. A nation of fairness for the many, not the privilege of the few. Concerns about those who use services as much as they care for those who provide services. Mr. Speaker, because we are the people's government, delivering the people's priorities in the people's context and budget yet, but seeking to do the people's building their business. Because this is the budget to ensure that we strengthen our common services again. Our budget to protect us in the long term with very little pain in the short term. With no giveaway, but no austerity either. With none of the benefits that we enjoy and value in Gibraltar being negatively affected. Because in particular, we respect our people. We believe in the Gibraltarian, in Gibraltar, and in Gibraltarian spirit. We trust our people. We trust them to understand the logic and weakness behind this budget. This people's budget, a fair budget, and a defense budget to lead to a rebirth of our public finances, to leave COVID behind, to make Brexit history, and to propel our nation forward. Because this is the budget in which I'm telling our people to ask not what more they can seek from our country. I'm telling our people to accept that now it's time for our country to take a little bit more from each of us. These increases are prepared to be in a position to give public sector pay rises again in the future. This is a direction to resolve the economic issues we face today, to repay the debt, to come back to focus, to protect our way of life, and to implement our prosperity. kind of get back to growth and bigger. Every Gibraltar and regular Gibraltar who cares about Gibraltar are people who want nothing more. Everyone is bigger, even though it contains fragmented, even though it contains those who treat us in a small way for a short period, even though it may feel like our medicine, it is the right appropriation for this medicine at this time. And I therefore unanticipatingly commend the bill to the House. Before I sit down with the speaker, given the length of my address, I would propose that the House should now recess before we return to hear other speakers at 3 o'clock this afternoon. The House will now recess until 3 o'clock this afternoon.